All right, so here we have familiar and unfamiliar trainers, large, small, and individual groups. And I didn't really have a quantitative group size variable. The people that I was getting these data from ran what were not only were large group, but were publicized as large group gatherings, and people chose what they came to. Whether it was large groups, small groups, individual, they were different places, different time, different costs. Same basic training, but this is self-selecting. So it isn't really a quantitative variable. This is really categorical. My quantitative variable was how motivated they were. So here's what we got. We got the group size by trainer, by motivation, interaction. That's the big dog. We got a group size by trainer, ignoring motivation. Group size by motivation, ignoring trainer. Trainer by motivation, ignoring group size. Just group, just trainer, just motivation. For every lower order effect, there is a corresponding simple lower order effect at the values of the other variables. I really want you to see the parallel between the green stuff and the blue stuff. For every lower order effect, there's a simple lower order effect. That we use the blue to figure out if we're going to talk about the green. We're going to use the simple effect of group size at every combination of trainer and motivation to decide whether we have a group size effect that's representative and or descriptive enough to talk about. So, here's what it looks like. Group size is the lines. Familiar and unfamiliar are blue and green. The quantitative variable goes on the x-axis. You would hardly ever do anything else. The large group shows the poorest performance, no real motivation effect, and familiar does a little better than unfamiliar. So if you will, this is the simple two-way interaction of motive and familiarity for large groups, which shows a familiarity advantage and nothing really going on motivation. You look at these two. This is the interaction of familiar and unfamiliar for individuals. And what you see is that as motivation goes up, the familiar trainer gives us an increase. Right? As motivation goes up, performance goes up for the unfamiliar. For the familiar, that's statistically flat. For individuals with familiar trainers is a waste of freaking time. Don't allow it. Now, you still get the individual doing better than the large group. That's the saving grace. But you don't get any motivation effect. If you look at the dashed lines, which is the small group, you see that the familiar outperforms the unfamiliar. Everywhere. So there's a lot going on in here. The familiarity effect is not descriptive. Familiar does better for large group. Familiar does better for individual, but familiar does not do better for small group.
Doesn't do well for individual.
If we compare these two, we get a familiarity effect. If we compare these two, we get a familiarity effect. If we compare these two, we get an unfamiliarity effect. Large group generally sucks. The large group never gets as good as the small or the individual. Picking between small and individual depends on if they're familiar or not and how motivated they are. Okay, so this is what I think of as a real three-way. It really matters. It gets ugly quick. Now here's the same design split out. Now we can look at how motivation and group size affects our similar and different, familiar and unfamiliar. I mean, the pattern that we get from both of these is that you get a motivation effect for small and individual in both familiar and unfamiliar. And large group sucks for both familiar and unfamiliar. But whether individual or small group does better depends upon familiarity. And whether there's much of a motivation effect depends upon familiarity. Here we have whether the social event is at the friend's house or a stranger's house. We have two quantitative variables, how familiar the people are with the other guests and how good their social skills are.
Is that like the number of guests you're familiar with them?
It was proportion of guests that they had met before. Was, I think, some version of that. So we've got a three-way, two ways and corresponding simple two ways, main effects and corresponding simple effects. I'm sorry, main effects and corresponding simple effects. And we get that. And one of the things you see is that we always get a social skills influence on performance. Yeah. Stranger's house gives us better performance than the non-stranger's house. Everywhere we look, we worry about the left-hand side. But the stranger effect is augmented by social skills. And we get this amazing lining up on high, medium. Now, remember that guest familiarity is a quantitative variable. But to draw lines, we're going to pick values. So high, medium, and low. High was one standard deviation above the mean. Medium was at the mean. Low was one standard deviation below the mean. So basically, I'm drawing a line for the average of the upper third, the average of the middle third, the average of the lower third. So the three-way that's there is about the differential split here, then there, then there. The lines are parallel here, damn near parallel there, obviously not parallel there. That's the interaction. The interaction of familiarity and social skills, the interaction between social skills and friend's house depends upon familiarity. With a bigger social skills by house interaction for high familiarity. The solid lines show more of an interaction. And again, here's what you get if you split it out. It's all the same data. We could have done it other ways. The question is, what gives you your best presentation? Stress, social support, and income. All quantitative. Doesn't influence the questions we have, the information that's available. And that's the hardest part, is getting past caring whether things are qualitative or quantitative. The only thing that really differs is if it's categorical, there's a line for a category. If it's quantitative, there's a line for a value. It's a mess. I got 9 lines up there because I've got high, medium, and low social support paired with high, medium, and low income, each with the slope that tells you about stress for each of those 9 combinations. Now, the one thing that you can see is that the light blue's sitting high. Low income people, except for a couple of occasions over on the high stress, the low income people are carrying more depression than everybody else. Among the darker blues, it gets a little mixy. At low stress, at high stress, it sorts itself out again. And here's what it would look like. You would have three graphs if you want to simplify things. For high, medium, and low income, showing the social support for each. And now we can see that there's a lot bigger interaction here. Now, the one thing I need to tell you is high income, remember, is relative. It's the top third. Nobody in this sample had a family income above 100,000. So high is high, high, high. The whole purpose for this study was to look for a thing called a buffering effect. In general, as stress goes up, depression goes up in married adults with children and jobs. That's what we had, all married adults with children and jobs. And these are both men and women, because I wasn't going to do the four-way and show you. It's a three-way class. The buffering effect hypothesis is that social support will mediate stress. That if you have high social support, it offsets, mediates, or buffers the stress effect. And the thing that I want you to notice, and what you really see when you lay it out this way, is the only place we got any meaningful buffering was in the higher income group. That's flatter than the other two. The high social support is flatter. Not here, not there. So the buffering hypothesis only works when you've got enough income that the stress isn't probably from money. That was one of the other things. That's the five-way. The four-way is to split it into men and women. The five-way is to split it into what proportion of stress is financial. Because these people, less of the stress was financial because they're making more money. Then you carry this thing and you take the depression and you carve it up into four different kinds of depression. And the four-way interaction depends upon the kind of depression you're talking about. But by the time we were done, we had not only changed the treatment regime, but we'd actually changed the way that social services evaluated people for service decisions. So we were paying attention to not depression, but depression and what are they stressed by? Who are they? What are they stressed by? How has it gotten to them? Now we're in a much better position, and we got almost a threefold increase in treatment outcome, which is most of the time what it's all about. Most of the really cool shit that I get to do is trying to take treatment outcome, choose it better for different kinds of people, and get better outcomes. Because you realize that you need different treatments for different people who are there for different things. Of course, when it takes a five-way to get you there, a lot of people aren't willing to do the work. So, that's just